Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. With me again in the studio today is Abraham Blondeau. I think you probably remember Abraham teaches history at our Imperial Academy here on the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus. So welcome, Abraham.
Thanks for having me back on the show.
Well, today, what I want to do is I want to complete our panel discussion on this important book, 13 Hours, The Inside Account of What Really Happened in Benghazi. If you remember the last time, we were about halfway through the Battle of Benghazi. So, Abraham, take us back to where we left off.
Sure. Last episode, we ended up closing the first battle, which was at the diplomatic compound. And that battle lasted about 3 hours. And that's where the GRS operators responded. That's where they couldn't find Chris Stevens, his body. They did find Sean Smith's body. And they are able to leave the diplomatic compound and go back to the CIA annex. And it's here. It's where the operators first learn about what kind of help they're going to get, or the lack of help they're going to get.
Yeah, I think it was more the lack of help. And I know this has been kind of a real controversial topic, but it's just the facts show that actually the requests for help that went on early on were not even, they just were told no. And then once the problem started, they were even told to stand down in Tripoli. So go ahead, Abe.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And that's basically what they found out when they arrived. So when the battle first started, the operators asked for a Spectre gunship and an ISR Pred. And what those are is an ISR Pred is a drone that has missiles on it. And the U.S. did send a drone, but it was just an observation drone that had no weapons on it. And it was providing a live feed of the battle to the Pentagon. So everyone in Washington, if they so choose, they could have watched the battle as it unfolded on the live drone feed. The Spectre gunship, that's an AC-130 Hercules, the big four-propellered plane. And basically the reason they wanted that is that it can provide close air support. It has heat recognition technology, so it can see in the dark. It can look for heat signatures. Night vision, it can fire artillery shells from the side of the plane and other 30-millimeter guns. So it can provide a lot of extra firepower that the operators didn't have, and it could really help them stave off really big attacks from any kind of militia element. And so they were really counting on getting a gunship, but as was revealed later, and as they were told here, any AC-130 was out of fueling range. So there weren't any set up in any airbase nearby where they could reach Benghazi. And I think that's a massive oversight by the U.S. military and the civilian people in charge of the military to make sure, or rather to let that kind of negligence show. Not that they expected this to happen, but they should always have military assets ready to help their ambassadors or other people.
I guess the big question that I have, Abraham, is that if Americans were really taking the information seriously, I mean, I think we've even said the last couple of programs is that there was at least 300 embassies warned that something like this could happen. And maybe we don't have enough C-130s to handle that. But you would think that if America was really facing the reality about Iran and Al-Qaeda and how Iran supports terrorism, that maybe Benghazi could have been singled out as a potential problem, and then we really would have had a C-130 near.
Yeah, exactly. I think if you look at the Middle East in 2012 and even today, and look how much turmoil there is, and it's really the most violent place in the world right now, and it's one of the few places where there aren't U.S. troops and where there aren't at least a big element of U.S. military firepower. I think that explains a lot of why it's so tumultuous and why situations like this can happen and why even these militias who are just young men with AK-47s, they can feel so bold as to attack the United States and not fear a reprisal. And that's because the United States wasn't there. There was no major force there. So I think that's a big part of it. And really with these the six men and a few other, there were around 10 who were defending the CIA annex in an active way. A lot of them probably would have survived the entirety of the battle if they could have some kind of air support during the battle.
Yes. Yeah, so it just seems like it was just a total lack of preparation, but also a total lack of wisdom and foresight. And especially when you're sending in, you know, like an ambassador, which I think we have to face, that the Islamic terrorists, or maybe we should say radical Islamic terrorists, love the big shows. That's why they took down the two towers in New York. Is they knew it would be filmed, and then they could show those films all over the world. And it's the same thing when you get an American ambassador in a situation where he's completely vulnerable. If they can get him, they've got the show. They've got the video clips. They've got the ability to kind of just keep republishing that over and over and over again, basically for free.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I think, a good point to illustrate the motivation of the different militias there. But I think this battle here at the CIA annex is the only one of the few bright spots throughout the Battle of Benghazi. And that's because just the professionalism and the bravery of the operators in defending the annex from two separate attacks. And it's, if you think to the timeline, it's around midnight in Benghazi. So the attack had been about 3 hours old. And this is when the first attack at the annex happens, where and it lasts for about 90 minutes, where there's sporadic gunfire, RPGs, different jihadist militants firing at the annex. And a lot of the CIA staffers are scared. They've never been in this kind of situation before. And I have a couple of quotes just to illustrate the kind of attitude that the operators had towards the battle, because it's a good moment just to reflect on their character and to back up what we've been talking about, their bravery and their courage. And this is talking about Roan. He helped patch up some injured guys who've been injured at the compound, the CIA agents, from smoke inhalation and other things. And this is a staffer, CIA staffer, talking to Jack Silva after the battle had taken place, and recounting what he said. Quote on page 203 in my version, Roan looked completely at home and in his element, the staffer told Jack later. He moved with confidence and wore a predator's grin. Roan's self-assurance buoyed the non-shooting staffers in Building C, who had finally acknowledged that their lives depended on the operators. The stack told Jack, he was like, yeah, we're going to unleash hate on these guys. He was ready to go to war, and he didn't care how many of them were coming. And I think that can be said of any of them, is that they didn't know what the odds were, and as we end up, there were probably hundreds of militia attackers.
I think they said at least 150 coming after them. So that was when you're, what, 6 to 8?
Yeah.
That's not really great odds.
Yeah, 25 or 30-1 odds. Yeah. But they were willing to fight, and they wanted to, because they realized that the lives of all these Americans were on the line, and so they weren't afraid to go into battle. They came at this challenge as predators, not as victims. And I think that's something to remember too, is that these former soldiers, they didn't think that they were victims of circumstance or they were victims of negligence. They thought they were predators fighting on behalf of the United States to stop the enemy, wherever they might be. And that's how they thought throughout this battle. Through this, we can really see the skill of the operators come to the forefront and how they could manage limited ammunition. They had night vision goggles, and they could easily out-battled the young Libyans who were attacking them, because most of them had no military experience. They were just young men who had bought rifles or stole them or had them given to them and were attacking. And so that's a big reason why so few could hold off so many, is because of that huge skill gap. And I think it speaks a lot for just the general skill of our soldiers at any time in the world, is that they are just the best. They have the best training. And even after they leave the army, they just know how to handle stress. They're the kind of people you want on your team when the chips are down and you're in a life-threatening situation.
Yeah, I think the thing is that when we talk about these young Libyans, is that they really get themselves fired up under like angry emotions, and that's what causes them to act. That doesn't mean they're acting out of rational thinking, but their whole main tactic is to inspire fear. Well, these guys, these contractors to the GRS, they're trained how to handle their fear. And in fact, when they get put in tough situations, they become fearless. And so in some ways, the whole Benghazi thing in terms of American military policy is really not any different than it's been for a long time, even from go back all the way to Korea. And we've made statements on Trumpet and Trumpet.com that America really has lost its will, or its will to fight, or it's lost the pride of its power. And you can see that because we do have a lot of soldiers that do want to fight, do know how to fight, do want to win, and they're stopped. They're prevented from doing it.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great point, is the political will of the nation is broken, but we can see not the will of all the Americans are broken
right
yet.
There's still individuals that still have that I think it should be a natural desire to want to protect our own.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have a quote here. I have a few quotes about what the operators were thinking during the battle. And this one is from Tonto, and it does touch on what you just mentioned, facing the fear of losing your life. And this is after the attack, after they stopped the attack by the militants. And they said, the discussion of what weapon and tactics they might encounter beyond rocket-propelled grenades and AK-47s made Tonto think about his wife and children. The idea that he might not talk to them again gave him chills. Tonto tried to force the thought from his mind. Tonto recalled a scene from the HBO television series Band of Brothers, in which an officer tells a frightened soldier in a foxhole to start fighting. He remembered a line about embracing death as a way to find the strength to fight. I don't want to die, Tonto thought. None of us wants to die. But it's a possibility, and if you don't accept that, it's just going to be in the back of your head the whole time, and you're not going to be able to function. So you accept it, you realize that you're not going to be able to talk to your family possibly ever again. Tonto took comfort in knowing that he told his wife and children how much he loved them during their most recent phone call, less than 24 hours earlier. But again, he tried to squeeze them out of his thoughts. He knew it was a vicious cycle. The more Tonto focused on his family, the less he could focus on doing his job well, which was the very thing that would increase his chances of returning to them. So I think that's just a good quote that really explains what probably all the men were thinking. All of them were married. All of them had children. And they're all thinking about those people who they love most and who would miss them the most if they did die. And so it was it is always a battle of the mind to stay focused on the task at hand. But you can see for these men, it was very personal. For the politicians in Washington, it was a decision of policy and of the big picture, which does have to be considered. But for these men, they were thinking about that too, but they were mainly thinking about it on a personal level of getting back home to their families, being able to talk to their wives again, talk to their children, and fighting well enough so everyone else in that compound could return home to their families as well.
Yeah, but when you talk about the political aspect of it, it's really weak political policy. I mean, that hasn't always been America's policy, you know, to back down or to not fight. That's very modern. That's very modern ideas, and it's kind of like. The whole idea in this country sometimes is, well, if we lay down our nuclear weapons, everybody else is going to lay down theirs. And that's just idealism at its extreme. And really, it's kind of like extreme stupidity. Because I know when I was a child, if I, you know, or a young boy, if I was getting in a fight with a friend or not a friend, an enemy, and they said, okay, well, let's just put our gloves down, we won't fight. That would have been, even as a young guy, I realized, well, that's not going to happen.
Right.
I put my gloves down. He's gonna go after me. So, but that is modern thinking. And it's not only in America, it is in a lot of our Western countries right now. And it's really it's not going to lead to peace. It's going to lead to, well, more Benghazis, only on a bigger scale.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And usually it's... those who are immediately in those situations that suffer the most, like these operators and the CIA staffers. So the return to the timeline, for 5 hours, there's a sporadic gunfire on and off. Most of it is, there isn't a whole lot of action, but they have to remain vigilant in case there is an attack. And at about 5:15, they find out that... Ambassador Stevens is confirmed dead, and that he's going to be escorted from a hospital to wherever they need to take him when they can leave. The Tripoli team arrives. Six operators from Tripoli arrive to add some reinforcements. And it's just after that that they get this final third attack, and it's with mortars. And what's so dangerous about this is that the operators had no chance at cover. They were hidden mortars, so they couldn't even fight back against them. And so this is when all the casualties are taken, is in this third attack. That's where Oz gets his arm severely injured and where he gets all the shrapnel in his body. This is also where Tyrone Woods and Glenn Doherty both die from direct hits from the mortars. And where Dave Ubin gets a severe injury to his leg. So it's all within this third attack. And it's these deaths that really bring home to the operators how small the chances are that they could have all died. Because the mortar attack stopped. And so after this, they were able to get to the airport. But here I have a quote, and this I think is the most impactful part from the book to me. And it's on the way from the airport, on the way to the airport from the CIA annex. Jack's reminiscing about Roan, because him and Roan had been in the Marines together. They had known each other for decades, and so that loss really hit him hard. And they were escorting the bodies in a small little. Pickup truck, and Jack was looking at the body and just thinking about these things, and this is what's written in the book. Jack thought about Roan's wife, Dorothy, and the infant son who had never known his father. He felt pangs of sadness as he recalled that Roan had told him Benghazi would be his final job as an operator, and how much Roan looked forward to getting home to be with his family for good. Jack winced as he remembered that Roan had extended this trip twice. One painful thought followed another. He felt crushed by the memory of Roan saying that he planned to surprise his wife with a trip out west to visit Jack and his family. She doesn't even know he's dead yet, he thought, and she won't know about that trip because it's never going to happen. Jack wished that someone else had met him at the airport 5 weeks earlier, that someone else had slipped a loaded pistol into his hand as a welcome gift. and that someone else had shown him the lay of the land so he'd do the good work and stay safe in Benghazi. But Jack also knew that Roan never shied away from protecting others or from doing what he thought was right. And so I think that passage really epitomizes what was lost in this battle. A lot more than just American prestige, but two husbands. Well, I guess Glenn wasn't married, but Roan left behind an infant son who he'd never met because of this, and because he had decided to stay longer, and he did want to do what was right, and all these operators did. And it's men like that that have kept America safe, and it's men like that that, despite all the mistakes made in Benghazi that night, these men were able to at least protect people and give a little more dignity to the name of America.
Yes. Well, I think that what's really most tragic about this is you can see when the mortars came in, that's a little more professional. There's a little bit, in other words, these aren't just the kids on the street. These are trained people that can shoot the mortars in, and it is sad, and it's really tragic that this came at the very end of the day when the day was almost completely won. And again, it is sad to lose someone like Roan, who was just a totally well-trained person, and and then the same with Doherty. I mean, these guys were highly trained, and they were good at their work. So that is tragic, but that is what happens when you have failed policies like we have. So I thought maybe what I'd do now is thanks a lot for that, Abe. And again, we haven't covered necessarily absolutely everything we could cover in the book, but that's up to you. That's up for your part to get in there and read it. But I thought maybe I'd just give a few final thoughts of my own. And again, just remember how we started this out. It's Benghazi is really the sad tale of America's leadership rejection of history. And if you remember back to our former programs, if you think about it, our government officials really did put Ambassador Chris Stevens and all these other Americans into a death trap because they didn't learn the history of Benghazi. I mean, and what happens with radical Islamic people when they get angry and upset, they go wild and they riot and they kill Americans. And I don't think America has ever faced the fact that there is a radical Islamic element being sponsored by Iran that's fueling all this, and then not only fueling it, it's funding it. And just a few events that happened just recently, in Ohio at the university there. I mean, this is not over by any stretch of the imagination, and it's going to get worse. In fact, America, I think, is in greater danger after Benghazi, because our enemies have studied our action and actually our lack of response to Benghazi. I mean, what has America done about it? What have we done about, an American ambassador being killed? Or what did the government in Libya do about it? They haven't really done anything about it. I just wanted to read just a little piece from an article that the editor-in-chief of the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine, he wrote an article called... this was in December 2012. He wrote an article titled "The Truth Revealed in the Benghazi Attack." And it really is an interesting article. And even though it's an older article, you can still order it or download it from thetrumpet.com. But he asked a question in this article, where is America's response? And I do think we have to be concerned about it. And sometimes Americans, we just kind of bury things. We just put it in the back of our mind and go out and party on the weekend. But here's what he says. He says, this tragedy also illustrates another prophecy being fulfilled. Now, we do talk at trumpet.com, and we do talk on our some of our other radio programs a lot about prophecy. He says, the Libyan terrorists killed America's ambassador and three others on the most painful date possible. And he's talking about September 11th or 9/11. And, of course, he's referring back to 2001, and that is a painful date. Americans, we memorialize on that date, but we know radical Islamists celebrate that date, and they're going to go after American interests on those days. says, yet months later, America still hasn't figured out how to respond. This is a massive insult to our country and our dead, but it doesn't infuriate our people the way it should. Now, here's Mr. Fleury goes on. He says, this is far more dangerous than it is insulting because America's pathetic response to this attack shows the entire world how weak America is. It is a spectacle of American weakness. And, of course, Mr. Fleury goes on to explain why we're weak and why we've lost the pride of our power. And so you can get this article and read it for yourself. And but he makes another, just I want to read just one more final quote. He says, America can bomb Gaddafi out of power, yet it is afraid to put boots on the ground to finish the job. That is a great way to sum up the whole Benghazi problem. Is we went in there to try and give the country democracy. We really didn't. We didn't do the whole planning that was needed to be done. He says, in this case, it's afraid to do so, even to save an ambassador and his men. The nation's terrorist enemies are happy to finish the job themselves, and we just hand it over to them. And so we have to be honest with ourselves that all Americans need to think about this and, really understand what happened there in Benghazi. And so... So I also want to remind you that, remember, we did offer at the very beginning of this series, we offered an article from Mr. Fleury called A Law of History. And again, we'd still like to offer that to you. And it is a fantastic article. And he does explain, again, our lack of understanding of history and how it's really affecting all of our thinking today. And so you can download a copy of Gerald Fleury's article, and that's the title of the article is A Law of History. You can download that at trumpet.com, or if you call 1-800-772-8577, you can request a free copy of that literature. And all of our literature is always free upon request, and we do no more follow-up. So you don't have to worry about us trying to contact you or to get you to join us. But we do have this information that is very, very valuable for you. So on December 26th, we'll begin JBL's Around the World series with Robert C. Thaler's short novel, A Whole Life. Also planned for this series is Helen MacDonald's book titled H is for Hawk. This is a breathtaking book of the nonfiction diary genre. So it's a diary. And in the book, Helen charts her training of a goosehawk as a means to help her recover from her father's death. And it's really quite a very interesting book. Now, I'll announce more of our upcoming series on Twitter and Facebook. Please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. That address is facebook.com, just the best literature. Now, you can also download the podcast at thetrumpet.com. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.